Welcome to Clarity, Not Consensus, a podcast shining some light on how our theological convictions about men and women are lived out in our ministry relationships and in the decision-making forums at all levels of the Presbyterian Church in New South Wales, in assembly committees, presbyteries, and in the local church. In this episode of Clarity Not Consensus, Anna Moss speaks with Dr. Claire Deaves about her research into how men and women work together on church staff teams in complementarian contexts. Serving both on her church's ministry team in Perth and as a theology lecturer, Claire began noticing that many theologically trained women were struggling to flourish in the workplace. Her research asks a simple but vital question. What does it actually look like when men and women work well together in complementarian settings? Where does it break down and why? I loved listening to this episode. It's an honest and constructive conversation. It's not about winning an argument, but cultivating healthy ministry partnerships for the goodness of the kingdom.
Well, good morning, Claire. It's good to have you with us. And I realise you're 2 hours behind, so it's an earlier morning for you than it is for me. So thanks so much for getting up early and joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Hi, Anna. Not that early.
That's good. So, Claire, thanks so much for coming to share with us today about your PhD. And just to kind of, get straight in there, can you maybe introduce yourself to our listeners? Can you tell us a bit about yourself, your background, and the work that you're currently doing?
Yeah, sure. So I'm in Perth. I've been in Perth now for 20 years, though I started life in Sydney. Since I've been here, I've done a range of ministries. I started in university ministry with the Australian Fellowship of Evangelical Students, then 10 years at Trinity Theological College full-time, and now I'm 4 days a week at Kallaroo Anglican Church, and I'm still lecturing in church history at college. So my job at church is a mash of things. It has been ministry amongst the women and sort of coordinating our training and a whole lot of those things that just pop up, a mission team, evangelism, that sort of thing. But we've just moved from 2 services to 3 services, so we're all working out what our new jobs are. I don't know exactly, but it'll be great.
Yeah, that sounds pretty busy.
It's reasonably busy, yeah.
So yeah. Somewhere in the midst of your busy ministry over the last few years, you managed to complete a PhD, which you completed in 2023. Title is pretty long. So I'm actually going to read out the title and then I'm just going to ask you a little bit about what made you interested in that topic. So the title is, and I hope I can even pronounce this correctly, so it's Working Together, it's a Phenomenological Study of the Working Relationship Between Women Employed in Complementarian Local Churches in Australia and the Senior Ministers with Whom They Work. So can you tell us, Claire, like what made you interested in choosing this topic for your PhD? What was the process by which you, you know, decided you wanted to do this? And can you talk us through that beginning process for you?
Yeah, so we'd all love our motives to just be driven by a desperate need to do research. I was lecturing at college, I needed a PhD. So I started with the premise that I needed a PhD and then had to sort of find a topic that was interesting enough to keep me going and something that I thought would be beneficial for the church. A lot of my life has been training women for ministry, but anecdotally it seemed that lots of women were doing their apprenticeships, going to college, going into ministry, and then it wasn't working. And one of the key areas that it wasn't working was in that relationship between the senior pastor and the woman who'd been employed. And so it seemed to me that there's no point training people for work for a long time if it doesn't work out. And so I wanted to have a look at that and see whether I could work out what it looked like when it worked, what it looked like when it didn't work, and therefore whether we could help it to work more often. So it was a really practical kind of driver, I guess. That's the short answer.
It's such an interesting topic. And I think I know there's been a lot of interest in, you know, in your research and your findings. And I think it is because it does touch on, such an important part of what it is to do work together as men and women. So can you explain to us what that big long word as well, phenomenological, hope I'm saying it right, what that means? Like, can you tell us about, how did you go about doing the research? How long did it take? What did that actually look like practically?
Yeah, no one needs to know what phenomenology is, Anna. But the short version is phenomenology is the study of phenomena, if you like. So what it really boils down to is how did women experience that relationship? It's all about experiences. But honestly, it's a fancy word for what I did. The truth of what I did was I interviewed a number of women about their experiences of working with senior pastors. Some who were still in the role, some who had moved to different roles, some for whom it had gone well, some for whom it had gone badly. So lots of interviews. And then some other women, a different set who were still in those kind of roles, kept diaries where they recorded 10 interactions between themselves and the senior pastor and reflected on whether it was a good interaction or a negative interaction, what made it good, what made it negative. And then looked at the interviews and the diaries, analysed them for themes. The themes were the same in the two different sets of data, which is always a positive thing in research. And broke that down sort of into a model. That was the gist of it. It was all done, it took 6 years, part-time PhD, but all the interviews and diaries were done before the pandemic, which is important. So it was done in normal world. The data collection, even though it was written up during the pandemic.
Yeah, that's so interesting. So for those women that were recording those interactions, about how long would they have been recording them for? Like, what was their
You mean over how many weeks?
like how long were they?
Some of them got it done really quickly. Some of them, they dribbled in forever. Yeah, there's no set answer to that. One person took almost a year to record 10 interactions, which wasn't, in theory, the way it was going to go. But most of them did it for a month or so and got that done. But they were only asked to record 10 interactions. So when you do research, you don't want to put too much burden on your participants.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Like even like just that also just as research, like getting people to look at concrete interactions. Like that's a really interesting self-reflective piece, I think.
Yeah, and it came too out of the thing that when you do interviews, what you're going to get is people's memory, which itself is a little bit hazy sometimes. But also the things that are going to stand out are the big things. The big things are the things you remember, not the day-to-day things. And so the diaries were there to pick up immediate day-to-day interaction. But like I said, it didn't change the themes at all. They revealed the same thing.
And just out of interest, how did you find the women? Like, did you know them personally? Like, how did that come about, your contact with these women?
Yeah, so I had contact with some people. I guess in research you'd call them gatekeepers. I know some people who know some people, and so I think Anna, I might have sent you an email, and someone in Queensland, and someone else in Sydney, and what I did was give them an email to send on to the women that they knew, but the women who received the email who wanted to be involved didn't go back through the person who had contacted them. They contacted me directly. So anonymity was huge for this research because it protects the bloke that they're working with as well as themselves. And if you want honest answers, then anonymity is really important. So in the thesis, I've gone to extraordinary lengths to scrub out what state they're in, what denomination they're in, because there's not enough of them, right? If I tell you three things about a woman in ministry in Sydney, you can probably tell me who it is. But they did come from five different capital cities in Australia.
So, from your research, Claire, what did you find most surprising? Like, yeah, were there things that you didn't expect, or did it confirm things that you thought you would see?
I was pleasantly surprised by how many positive interactions there were. That was definitely one of the surprises, and that was a good surprise. I was also surprised by how not gendered the answers were. So I think in a minute we'll talk about the findings, but the things that made that relationship between senior pastors and the women working with them work well, I think would be the same thing as if they were guys. I think the consequences when it went wrong were a little bit different. So because I was dealing with women in complementarian churches, that did make a difference possibly to how women experienced it when it went wrong. But on the whole, it wasn't particularly gendered. That surprised me. I thought there'd be a chapter on gender, and there wasn't in the end, because hardly any of it was gendered.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So you're saying there that the kinds of themes that you were noticing in the interactions were things that could have, as equally come up between like a male assistant with the senior.
Yeah, so for example, all of the women, we'll get to the model in a minute, but all of the women talked about the importance of having a voice and being heard. It's hard to imagine that a male assistant doesn't want to have a voice and be heard. You know, it, just the same kinds of things as you'd expect. Now, I can't prove that. I haven't done the research among the blokes, but it's hard to imagine it being terribly different, I think.
So, what for you did you find most encouraging? I mean, you have mentioned just before that the fact that it was more positive in some ways, that was more encouraging, but were there other aspects that you did find encouraging?
Oh, the women I met with were just a remarkable bunch of women, godly, mature women. Even the ones who, I mean, I've only heard one side of the account, obviously, but the ones you'd say sort of objectively were not treated very well, were still gracious. I think if it wasn't all, it was certainly most of those who'd ended up resigning because things were that bad. Still said he's a good guy and he belongs in ministry. They may not have been convinced that the senior pastor was the right role for him, but there was loads of just grace. And I think their kind of toughness in ministry came out in the interviews, the ones for whom it was going well and the ones for whom it didn't work. Their ability to absorb things and push on and get stuff done. Yeah, definitely the most encouraging thing was just meeting the women, and they were a pretty remarkable bunch. Yeah.
That's one of the things in my job that I love is just, coming alongside people in ministry. And it's very humbling and very encouraging, to see
Yeah.
faithfulness at work. So for you, what was something that you think was most concerning? Like something that might have been alarming, concerning in the research?
Look, definitely the hardest thing was listening to the stories of the women for whom it had gone wrong and seeing how catastrophic that was.
Okay.
So a lot of women in ministry are single women, and to sort of have to resign for various reasons, they've lost their job, they lose their church family at the same time. That's one of the things in ministry. You lose your job and your church family together. If you're in church housing, you lose your house on the same day. And they almost always lost huge amounts of confidence. Again, if it wasn't all, it was certainly most of them weren't in ministry for some time after things had gone wrong. Some of them have gone back into ministry, some of them haven't. And so the catastrophic results for them, the implications for their life and their emotional health and all of that was definitely the most concerning thing. And a thing that spurs me to think, yeah, we've got to do something about this. It's unloving, actually, to not sort of deal with this problem, because it has human.
Well, big human implications,
It
doesn't
has big human implications. That's right. Yeah, it affects real people's lives massively. Yeah, and that's talking to the women. I suspect it also was really damaging for the churches. You know, people do get attached to their ministry team, and when the ministry team doesn't work well, even if they handle the leaving process well, that's hard for the members of the church. So the consequences when it went wrong, that was definitely the most concerning thing. It's not trivial.
No. And I think that's something that I do think quite a few of us understand, isn't it? That, in normal secular work, when that goes wrong, that can have, very significant implications for people, most definitely. But the nature of ministry and how embedded people's lives are in terms of it's their local community, it's their local church, it's their friendships, it's their housing, it is every aspect of their lives. It's their own relationship with God, isn't it? Like, there's no aspect of your life that doesn't get impacted when that ministry relationship breaks down.
Yeah, that's right. But they all have persevered in faith, which is terrific. And yeah, continue to serve God in various ways, though not all in vocational ministry anymore.
So we've just been talking about the huge need for this kind of research because the implications, are so significant for people. Can you talk us through what are those main findings that we can learn from through your research, Claire?
Yeah, so the big thing to say is it's not rocket science, it turns out. I feel like this is the most ridiculous PhD ever written, and it's just that the first person to write it down gets a PhD. The overarching thing, so for those who are listening, if you picture a circle or a rectangle at the top in the middle and put the word partnership in it, if you've got a sense that you're working in partnership with someone, the relationship will probably be good. Now that's partnership in something, right? So you know what you're doing, you're working on it together, you've got this real sense of partnership. That seemed to be the thing that drove good relationships. And conversely, if that's not there, then the relationships were much more difficult to navigate. That's all lovely, but what does that actually look like? So then mentally draw yourself three circles or rectangles under that. There was three big feeders that go into that. The first one is being able to make a valuable contribution. So you feel like you're working in partnership if you've made a valuable contribution, which means two things. It means it's a substantial contribution, and it means it's valued. So other people value the contribution that you're making. So if you're not able to do that, you can see how that doesn't feel like partnership anymore. I don't really get to do anything. An example, if I was on a team and the only job I was ever assigned was to help write name tags on the night at an event, I think I'd be inclined to say, I'm happy to do that. Ask me on the day. I don't need to be on this team, right? That's not the sort of contribution that's going to drive me really wanting to be on the team. So that ability to make a substantial contribution was really important. And then the second box or circle over, having a voice and being heard, really hard to have a sense of partnership when you don't have a voice. It doesn't feel like you're working together. It's harder to do your job, but it's also just harder to feel trusted, respected. A lot of those things come with voice. So that's the second one across. And again, there's two elements to that. One is cultural, that culturally there's a sense in which you can speak in a meeting. So it's not just that the meeting is there and that you're in the room, but the culture is such that people don't fly off the handle if you disagree. There's an invitation for you to actually say something. The meeting's run in a way that means you can speak. It's a positive team culture. And then the other branch of that one is structural. So it's you can actually be structured out of the meeting. You're not in the room where decisions are being made about things that are really important for your job. That's no good for your sense of partnership either. You need to be, the right people in the room. And that doesn't mean that you have to be in every room, but someone representing your voice needs to be in the room, or you've got access to the senior pastor separately and he's taking it into, like, there needs to be some way for your voice to be accurately represented in that room. I have views about that. We can come back to that if you want to.
I've already thought, I'm interested in this. Yes, I'll come back to that one for sure.
Then your third one is personal relationship. So you need some sort of positive personal relationship, which actually doesn't mean that you need to be best friends, but some sort of personal concern from the senior pastor to the person who's working for him. No one wants to be like a tool in someone else's ministry who they only care about as much as you care about a hammer. You want to, how are you? Oh, your dad was sick. How's he going? Just a really basic level of personal concern. Things have been horrendous lately. Do you need an afternoon off? Just that sort of level of care for the person. So they're the three big things. There was a bunch of skills that sort of supported them, but they're really the three main things that drive a sense of partnership. Hopefully you can see that if you had all those three things going for you, it would work reasonably well. And if you don't, it's probably broken down in one of those.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, and as you're saying, you can see that those concepts and themes, are, important in all effective partnerships, be they, male, female, or male, male. But obviously, one of our particular interests, here is looking at the way in which women and men work together.
Yeah.
And that's, that was, a key focus of your PhD. I know you know a little bit about our context here in New South Wales, and one of the big questions that we're continuing to ask ourselves is, how do we effectively engage and involve women in decision-making processes within the church, and specifically within the courts of the church? So we're looking at the local level, which is sessions. We're looking at regional levels, which is presbyteries, and then the state level, which is the state assembly. And there's ongoing discussion around, how do we do that better? How do we involve and include women more? I'm just curious to hear from your research. Yeah, what some of your thoughts are? What are some of these opinions, Claire? I'm very curious to hear, like, what might be some of the implications, the practical implications for these kinds of questions, in a denominational setting?
Yeah, well, why don't I just put my cards straight on the table for some of the issues that the Presbyterians are discussing? I'm not a fan of the idea of having women as elders, and I'm not a fan of the all-male elders meeting. And I don't think those two things have to go together, is where I've sort of come to. So the big one we're talking about here is having a voice and being heard. And I think if we're genuinely complementarian, it's not about what women can't do. It's about the fact that we need men and women. If you don't think you need women, then you're not complementarian. You're exclusivist, right? You think men should do everything. The word itself carries the idea that we need both men and women. And I think that means you need male and female voices when you're making decisions. But I don't think submission needs to be structured in. And so by way of sort of analogy to a marriage, right, we want husbands to love their wives, wives to submit to their husbands, but we'd never say to a newly married bloke, don't ever discuss a decision with your wife. Or you wouldn't want to be talking to your wife about things. You just go and sit on your own and make a decision. The way that plays out is relational. And I think you can be in a room. I think women do it all the time. They go into rooms, you know who the elders are, they know that's not them. You have a conversation, and as the decision's being made, they know when to be quiet and when to submit. And I'll get that wrong sometimes. But you know what? The blokes get leading wrong sometimes. We both get our jobs wrong sometimes. And I'm not sure we need to have these structures where we've structured in that women, this, well, it's not actually active submission, that women are excluded in case they overstep. I think we need to trust women more than that to be able to be in the room and still submit to the elders while they're in it. And I think you'll get better decisions if you do. You'll have both better information, because the women have information that you don't have, just by nature of who they're interacting with, but you'll also get the benefit of the complementarity of having men and women see things differently and come at it from different angles and make good decisions together. And you'll have more people in the church who are on board with the decisions that you've made and running with them wholeheartedly. So that's sort of my big takeaway in a Presbyterian setting would be. Yeah, I think you can have male elders and still have women in the room. And I don't think that that is a fake distinction. I don't think you're saying, oh, we won't call them elders, but they really will be. I think you want to learn how to express culturally that the elders lead, that the women in the room are submitting to the elders. But actually, mostly, we're just working together. That the bigger thing is that we're working together and we work things out and we work out what we should do together. Which I take it is how you want marriages to work, actually. Like, you're working it out together. That's my headline thought, Anna.
Yeah, that there's the structural aspects, which is kind of who gets to be in the room and the kind of the rules around that. But then there's also the cultural, which is the more relational. Can
Yeah.
you tell us a bit more about, like, what do you think from what you've observed, helps to create healthy and positive cultural dynamics.
Yeah, so in that particular setting where you're talking about getting that kind of submission thing working, you'd want to be sure that you have the same understanding of that before you add people to your team, right? People need to be able to say, okay, that's the model that we want to work. And then you want to trust each other that actually everyone's trying to be godly. The women want to submit because that they share your theological convictions, and the guys want to lead and listen because they're complementarian and they value the voices of women. So we need to trust each other to be in the room, I think. I think Australians actually do this all the time without it having any gendered thing. So if I think about our staff meetings, we'll have a discussion about something. We all have ideas, we throw them in most of the time that we get there. Every now and then I'll sense that the boss is not keen and he's sort of made a decision, and we stop and we go, yeah, all right, let's run with that. I do that, but so does the other male assistant, because he defers to him as senior pastor as well. It's actually the way Australians find consensus all the time. So I think we not infallibly, but I think we have it built into our culture. I think that's how workplaces work in Australia. We don't feel our hierarchy very strongly, and yet everybody knows who the boss is in the meeting, and so you're watching that dynamic all the way through. But I think the other things that help, look, guys need to know, I think, that women do not respond well to aggression. So the kind of aggressive arguing in meetings probably means that a woman's not going to contribute very much ever. If that's the normal tone of your meetings, certainly like yelling in a meeting is not okay. You'd hope that I wouldn't have to say that, but it turns out you do. It's not okay for Christian staff meetings to involve people yelling at each other. I think you create good environments if you're the leader by the way you take criticism. And bad environments if you don't take it well, right? So if it becomes obvious that disagreement is going to sort of lead to really uncomfortable situations, it's not okay to disagree with the leader. That will make the culture of speaking really hard. Being happy to have disagreement, inviting disagreement is going to help, and not attaching people's ideas to the person. Once the idea has hit the table, then we discuss it as an idea, we don't attach it to the person. In some environments, we jump on people if they don't dot every theological I and cross every theological T every time they speak. That is not going to help people have a voice. So we need to be just gracious in the way that we speak to one another. There's a sense in which setting up that cultural environment is just a matter of being godly. Actually, if you're patient and you're gracious and you're listening, you'll end up with that. With that environment.
That's really helpful. And it seems to me, in terms of those three big themes, that they really work together, I imagine, because I'm thinking about what we see happening in those more formal decision-making contexts, be that a staff meeting or, a session meeting or a presbytery. What we see happening in those more formal contexts, I imagine the flavor of what that looks like is really impacted by what that personal relationship looks like, and the kinds of interactions that are happening in other spaces, and the kinds of contribution that women are making outside of those. Can you talk to me a little bit about kind of how you see them working together?
Yeah, they really do all work together. Absolutely. Let me give you a negative example. This is one that happened in the study. So in the valuable contribution column, there was one woman I spoke to. She was employed as a children's minister. And over time, I think the way she came to understand it was, he has employed me so that he never has to think about children again. Right? Which means that she was making a substantial contribution in the sense that it was massive, but it wasn't valued. He didn't care, he wasn't interested, which meant that her voice wasn't really heard when she came to him and said, "This is what I need." He just wasn't that interested. And so what she was saying wasn't being heard, it wasn't being acted on. She didn't feel like she could ever get anywhere. What he wanted was for her to go away and do it and not talk to him about it. You'd be shocked to learn that that didn't lead to a great personal relationship, right? So she feels like he's not listening all the time, and of course that doesn't lead to a great personal relationship. And so yeah, that's one that ended in resignation. That blew up. Oh, it took a long time, but you can only live in that sort of working relationship for so long before that's just too hard. So that's a really neat example of how they fit together. Whereas I think about a positive example, another woman I spoke to, you can see it in the having a voice thing. The senior pastor often went to her and said, "I know this isn't your role, but I want your opinion on this. I want to know what you think." And so she was able to make all sorts of contributions to the life of the church, not just in her area, but outside her area, because he wants to know. And so she feels like she's contributing something in this partnership they have in the gospel. And their personal relationship is really positive because she feels respected and trusted, and like he values her. And so, yeah, the three absolutely are working together. Sometimes you can isolate the problem to this is the one where it broke down, and it led to the other two. So I can think of one relationship which I'd say was somewhere in the middle. What I would call, I had positive relationships, negative relationships, and ambiguous relationships. This one was an ambiguous one. It was the structure of voice. She'd been structured out of the meetings that she needed to be in. Decisions were being made that had massive consequences for her. She wasn't in the room, and that made it hard for her to make a contribution. Even though they got on quite well personally, it put this strain in the relationship. But you could trace the origin of the problem really specifically to their meeting structure. That's what led to it breaking down. And so I guess one of my hopes for this sort of model to put in front of people is that if you are in a working relationship that's not great, it might help you to pinpoint where it's gone wrong so that you can have a fruitful conversation about it. Because it's just not working for me is a conversation that doesn't go anywhere. Whereas if you can sort of go, it's not working for me, and I think it's because I don't feel like I'm contributing anything valuable, or I think it's because I don't have a voice in decisions that affect me, or whatever it might, I think you'll have a better conversation.
Yeah, that's really useful. Just that the way that your themes can provide a sense of structure and reflection for people. Because I think that's so true, isn't it? When people are often in the middle of relationships that don't feel that they're working, it can be really hard for people to find their way and have those constructive conversations. Was there anything that came out in the research, Claire, about the things that were helpful? Like if there were problems that people encountered, what were the kinds of things that either helped people to move through those difficulties in an effective, fruitful way, or maybe what were the things that contributed to things breaking down? Because obviously, we're not expecting that ministry relationships are perfect. It's probably about how do we deal with difficulties when they arise. Was there anything that came out there in terms of the way problems are dealt with and the different outcomes?
I wish I had a better answer for you, Anna. I think it was my observation that lots of the relationships worked because the women were able to accept that the people you work for and with are not perfect. And so there are things that you just push through, right? I think a lot of what made relationships work was just being gracious with the person you worked with, being patient and pushing through. But I don't think I came across a single instance where once it was pretty bad, it was solved. We're not good at working through it. So I wish I had a better answer for you. But once you've sort of reached the point where you're saying this really isn't working, I didn't come across an instance where it got fixed. It might have been sort of improved for a little bit, but not actually fixed. So yes, there's a lot of little things you can put up with, and that's not terminal. But once they snowball into something significant, we're not good at fixing that. I wish I had a better answer.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that is concerning, isn't it? But I guess that's, I imagine, some of your hopes for the research, Claire. Like obviously you've observed that when things started to go wrong, it wasn't like you weren't seeing examples of things that were really positive in coming out of that. Can you talk to me a bit more about, what hopes do you have? I imagine you've not written this so that it just gets put on a bookshelf somewhere and no one refers to it. Like, how would you like to see your findings used in a practical way, to actually improve what we're seeing happen in churches and staff teams?
Yeah, so like I said, once it snowballs, there doesn't we're not good at finding a way through that, and someone else probably should do some research into that. I'd like to see it used to help us to not get to that point, so that at the first hint of things not going wrong, people can use the model and say, I think that's the problem. We can have a conversation about that. I think senior pastors could look at it and run the grid for all their staff. Am I giving them all a chance to make a valuable contribution? And keep in mind that. That heading is true for everyone, particularly if the women don't preach in your church. It'll be harder sometimes for them to see that they're making that valuable contribution. The way that the congregation relates to them is different because they don't preach. And so there's some extra work to be done, I think, in helping women to know that they're making a valuable contribution. So the senior pastor could sit down and say, okay, am I allowing all my staff to make valuable contributions? Or is someone getting a whole lot of jobs that they're never going to feel like they're contributing much? Or am I micromanaging so much that they don't feel like they've got any freedom to make a contribution? Do they all have a voice? Am I listening to them all? How can I get them a voice? Do I need to set up individual meetings with them more often than I do? And how am I caring for their staff, for my staff? So I think the senior pastor as well can run through the grid and say, these are the things. And then I think, like I said, there are some skills that sit under it. It's a little bit hard, probably, to doing the podcast, work through all of that. But when it comes to training people for being the senior pastor or working out whether someone should be the senior pastor, it's not some weird secret sauce, right? There's a few skills that you need to have, and they come partly as a result of training and partly as a result of gifting. So some of them you can learn, and then you might be good to go. And sometimes we need to say, that's just never going to be me. And there's no moral failing in not being a senior pastor. So if that's not the skill set you have, if you're not wired that way, then be an associate. That's great. So an example of one of the skills you need, the senior pastor, and this is probably teams of more than two. When you've only got two people, that's a different kind of dynamic. But you need some sort of ability to define roles clearly and set up structures that work together, right? And if you can't do that, then your staff will be tripping over each other all the time, and it'll be really, really frustrating. And their ability to make a contribution gets lost because they don't know what they're supposed to be doing. And often they're not being heard because the structures don't contribute to them being heard. Or similarly, if we're going to have partnership, it's got to be in something. So if you're no good at defining strategy or leading the process of defining strategy, then this is, again, probably not the role for you, senior pastor, because if I'm going to have a sense of partnership, if I'm going to make a valuable contribution, it needs to be to something, and I need to know what the something is. And so there's just some basic skills like that, that we can focus on teaching. And also use as a little bit of a diagnostic for, are you built this way? Is this a good job for you? There's lots of roles in ministry that are not senior pastor. If this is not your thing, then that's okay. But you can do damage to other people if you try and push through when it's really not your thing.
You've talked about a couple of examples there, Claire. For example, you've used the importance of a clear role description and a practice of a senior pastor, coming and intentionally asking, a female leader what her opinions are. Are there other practical sort of skills or practices that you observed in your research that were really helpful? Like, yeah, what are the kinds of skills and practices that senior ministers, can be, leaning into and prioritizing that can make a difference, helpfully.
It's so funny because most of what came out as the skills you need became obvious when people didn't have them rather than when people do, which was just interesting to observe. So, for example, it doesn't sound amazing, But basic organizational skills really matter, right? So if you're the last minute person, that might work for you. It doesn't work for the rest of your team, right? Or if you're the person who's always changing their mind. So, you know, Anna, can you go and work on this? And then you put 30 hours of work into it. And then I go, oh yeah, we're not going to do that anymore, right? You can live with that once, but if that happens five times, your ability to make a contribution has been stifled, and you're starting to get pretty frustrated. And it comes across as just inconsiderate in terms of the personal relationship. So just those basic organizational skills. Does my staff team know what they need to know to do their job? Is a really important kind of thing. You obviously need reasonable communication skills for all of it. Trying to think about the specific examples of things that came out.
Yeah, like either specific practices that were helpful or, yeah, practices that were unhelpful. I'm just curious to hear, were there some practical examples that were quite obvious and repeated through research?
On the whole, the relationship did better if the senior pastor met individually with the person employed. Because it gives voice, and just that giving someone your time shows that you value them and what they do. The difficulty with that in a really big church is that it's impossible. And so, just a little bit of nerdy stuff for a minute. Another name for what we've been talking about is leader-member exchange, which is the relationship between the leader, the senior pastor in this case, the member, the woman working for him. There is some evidence, it hasn't been nailed down yet, but some evidence that team member exchange can substitute for it. So if you don't have a great, you've got a thin relationship rather than a negative relationship, you've got a thin relationship with the senior pastor, but a great relationship with some other assistant that you're working with, then you're still feeling all that partnership that you need to be getting on your job. You still feel like you're contributing. Your voice is being heard somewhere. So if you're the senior pastor and you can't meet with everyone, you really want to foster that team member exchange, that everyone is developing a good working relationship with someone else on the team, if that makes sense. And then what you need to be really aware of, because there are a couple of examples of this as well, let's say my boss has gone, team member exchange is what we're going to have to use. And so I've got a really good working relationship with the person that I'm sort of co-pastoring a congregation with. And then he leaves, then my whole experience of work has just changed. And it's not just because we have jobs that aren't being done, it's because relationally, that's what was carrying me through work. And so you really need to keep an eye out for what the changes in your staff team and how it affects people's working relationships as well is really important.
That's so interesting. You've probably heard of, you know, the Billy Graham rule, you know, like the kind of that idea of, you know, a man and a woman should never, you know, be alone together. What's your thoughts about that? And, you know, how do we have helpful leader member or team member exchanges that are going to have, you know, good and fruitful outcomes? Can you share your thoughts on that one, Claire?
Yes, it can be very, I think that can be really overdone. I think if women feel like they're in an environment where they feel like they're being treated as suspect, right? Every woman who you might work with is clearly out to ruin your marriage. That is incredibly unfair to the women. They're concerned for their godliness too. And if they're not, you shouldn't have employed them at all, right? Like, I think the kind of, as soon as someone says, could you pass me a knife? Clearly, adultery is the next step. We just need to wind back from that. That's insane. Women need to be treated with respect. And that means that if you're the senior pastor, and not just with the women you work for, but the women in your congregation, you are their pastor. Like, you have to be able to have one-to-one conversations with them. Like, where you do it, how often you do it. I think you need to be honest with yourself. Maybe accountable to someone else. If you can see a problem's brewing, then you need to take steps to stop it. It doesn't usually happen in an hour. You're not going from zero to adultery in an hour. But over time, if you see a problem coming, then yeah, you need to modify your behavior. But to just treat all women as suspect all the time is really, really unhelpful, I think. And there isn't a set of rules that's going to keep you out of trouble. Again, don't be foolish, but our sinfulness is not really the result of structures.
Yes. You talked about the fact that quite a few of the things you found, were not necessarily gender specific, that they would be applicable for male assistants or men who are, working alongside or under the senior pastor. What are the kinds of things, though? I mean, we've just talked about that now with the Billy Graham rule, but are there specific things that you think do impact women more individually, more uniquely? In complementarian settings.
Yeah, in a complementarian setting, I think it does. And two things. When it goes wrong, it's usually easier for a male assistant to find another job, and it just looks like he's moved to another job. And so we never know that it actually went wrong. But I also think when it goes wrong, female staff in complementarian settings are a bit more stuck. So let's say you take the example where the senior pastor's not good at strategy. A male assistant might just step in and do it. Whereas the female assistant, because she doesn't want to be running the church, won't step in and do it. So she's just stuck, right? Like the kind of, we want the senior pastor to be taking the initiative. He's not. I think it affects women more because they're not going to step in and do it. Rightly, I think, not going to step in and do it. And so I think that's how it plays out, is that they end up a bit more hamstrung if the senior pastor isn't leading in a way that they need to be led. That seemed to me to be the main thing, and which is why, again, in a couple of situations, things went well for a while where there was a particular assistant on team, and then that assistant left, and then it blows up. Because it turns out that assistant had been filling some of those gaps. And without him there, the relationship doesn't work anymore. I think that's the main gender thing, is what happens when it goes wrong.
That's a really helpful distinction. So just finally, are there things that I haven't asked you about? Is there something that we haven't touched on that, you really want to share that you think is, particularly for our Presbyterian context as well, but are there things that you really want to impart to us that you haven't had a chance to discuss so far?
Look, I do want to say, don't be scared of employing women. It really isn't, there's not some weird female code that needs cracking before you can work well with a woman or whatever. It really is pretty similar to working with the men. So I think we need to be less scared of each other and more about working together, less about worrying about all the boundaries around being complementarian. We need to work out what our boundaries are, absolutely. But if we get stuck there and that's all we talk about, instead of talking about let's get on and work together, because actually the way God's made us is beautiful for the church because we're working together rather than a burden for the church because we're always worried about tripping over the boundaries. I think we lose something really precious. So just if we could all be a little bit less scared of it, I think that would be a real win for us. That'd be one thing I'd say. I'm going to regret that I didn't take more of this opportunity in due course, I think. But we've talked about most of what I'd want to say, I think.
So much good stuff there, Claire. And yeah, I really appreciate you taking the time today, but also, the hours of time you took in doing that research and really being able to get this stuff out there. And I think it's, as you've said, in some ways it's not rocket science. In some ways it kind of does, I guess, support things that we might expect. But I think doing this as formal research really lends a certain gravitas to it, which I think is so helpful in being able to have good conversations. And that's something that, we're really trying to do, is we're really trying to foster, good, robust discussions about how men and women can work together well. So thank you for contributing today, but thank you in general for contributing, you know, to this discussion. It's really, really valuable, and it's a really important thing for us to keep talking about together.
Thanks, Anna. I'm glad you're talking about it.